I am a universalist. I realized this a couple of years ago. Actually, I didn't even know what universalism was until a couple of years ago. Whenever I heard or saw the dual letters UU, I always thought it was some kind of typographic burp. But now I know, and I can't think of a better theology for our times than one of divine love for all beings without the pernicious fear of hell. Projecting ourselves back in time to the beginning of the 19th century, we can imagine how revolutionary universalism was from Chris's reading of the Winchester Profession of Faith. At that time, universalist churches were extraordinarily autonomous. So much so that in response to being taxed to support the established congregational churches in New Hampshire, they had to mount a major convention to prove themselves to be a separate denomination. So in 1803, their leaders met in that small West New Hampshire town of Winchester, right on the border with Vermont, to craft a creed. Apparently, many pastors were opposed to writing any sort of document, claiming that it would impede the individual freedom from religious dogma. Sound familiar? At the end, the group finally agreed upon a statement of faith. What is beautiful about the Winchester Profession is not just what it states, but the immense amount of wiggle room left unsaid. The Hebrew Bible and the New Testament contain a revelation of God and destiny, not the singular revelation. This clause paved a road for religious inclusiveness. Any religion might contain alternative revelations. For me, the key points are that there is one God whose nature is love, and that holiness and happiness are inseparably connected and will be restored ultimately to everyone. God as love is profound. God is beyond gender, beyond description. God is that relational energy that draws us together in peace. But the profession is more than just a declaration of love. It is a blueprint for the good life. The realm of the holy, that space and time that is set apart from our ordinary ambitions, dreams, and activities, is the ultimate source of our happiness. And indeed, all humanity, and through our current UU lens, all nature, will finally be restored to holiness and happiness. As a psychiatrist whose lifelong aim has been to promote happiness and relief from suffering for my clients, universalism offers us a very visceral path to contentment. Rather than medications or reconciling inner conflicts, the route to happiness is through a personal and communal commitment to the holy, to invoke the spirit of love without ceasing. With the Winchester Profession, Universalists were finally able to carve out a distinctive identity. How did this identity differ from our sister denomination at the time? Well, by many gauges, Unitarians and Universalists were quite different, which is one reason why it took such a long time until 1961 for the two groups to merge. By and large, Unitarianism was a large city, most notably Boston, upper middle class and upper class phenomenon, while Universalism tended to be a rural, working class, West New England movement. Many Universalist pastors were former Baptists. Many Unitarians were renegade Congregationalists. One pithy contrast is attributed to our very own Thomas Starr King, after whom our congregation has been named, who proposed that Universalists believe that God is too good to damn people, and Unitarians believe that people are too good to be damned. However, what Universalism gains in theology and ethics, it may lack a bit in the symbolism of its worship. If we are all to be reconciled to holiness and happiness, where stay the souls of those gone before us? The Catholics and Episcopalians have retained the idea of the communion of saints. All Christian beings, both living and dead, who are united in the body of the church. In this context, a saint is not a perfect person, far from it, but a being to whom we all feel connected in love. I think of my ancestors as saints, and I will tell you the story about one of them who was as fundamentalist a Christian as they come, but whom the spirit of Universalism also touched over a century ago. John Wesley Holloway, my great-grandfather, whom I've spoken about before, was born in Georgia in July 1865, a mere 3 months after the end of the American Civil War. He was a Congregationalist minister, a rare breed among African Americans at the time, most of whom were often African Methodist or Baptist. One such Methodist was, in fact, John's father, Houston Hartsfield Holloway, who had been a slave on a rural Georgian plantation and after the war became an African Methodist minister. Makes sense he would name his son John Wesley. Now, although John was a conservative Congregationalist, he was also an innovative poet, one of the first to write in African-American dialect, in addition to scripting late Victorian devotional poems. 40 years ago, my mom found both John's and his father's autobiographies in a dusty attic in the home of her uncle. And John's father's slave autobiography later became part of the rare books collection of the Library of Congress on account of its unique descriptions of slave and post-emancipation life in society. As a young man, I'd often read John's autobiography, glancing over sections he termed unusual psychic experiences, ascribing them to the irrational ramblings of an eccentric. But a couple of years ago, I decided to delve into these sections, and I was floored by what I read. Around 1893, when John had just graduated from Fisk College, he was working alongside a white friend, Phil Thurman, in a blacksmith shop in Turin, Georgia. Now, Phil had formerly been the superintendent of the Methodist Sunday School of the town, but had recently fallen from grace. Apparently, the two sons of the village big man had gone off to the University of Georgia and had returned as avowed infidels, as John Wesley Holloway had termed it. Phil's job was basically to deprogram them back into the folds of Methodism. But Phil got converted by the young men, and here's where it gets really interesting, and started attending the local Universalist church in Turin, Georgia. It was only a few miles down the road. Later, Phil himself was drawn to spiritualism, as many of the 19th century Universalists also were, according to Dan Harper of Palo Alto UU Church, who is a profound well of historical information. I might add that Aidan Ballou also became a spiritualist and during the course of his work at Hopedale. So Phil talked with and gave books to my great-grandfather about spiritualist philosophy. John then went home, had a few psychic experiences, like hearing spirits knock in response to questions. Afterwards, John's father, the devout African Methodist, berated his son for such heathen activities, at which time John's spiritualism went dormant. What most impresses me about this story is the intellectual friendship between a black man and a white man in the Deep South at the height of Jim Crow segregation laws. It also speaks to the contagiousness of universalism, encompassing all of us in divine love. Not just John Wesley Holloway or Phil Thurman, black or white, me or you, but all beings partake of the community of saints, the communion of the blessed, communities of love. Or in John Wesley Holloway's own words in his poem, Biopsis, "A saint is eternity, plant by birth. They live in God's life, though they be gone. And they with God move on and on. Be glad, ye saints, and sing, ye lands. Ye leafy bowers, clap your hands. There's grace and truth in him above, and his intimate name to us is love." Amen.